Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today's Scholar Circle was recorded before a live audience and explored the future of Europe and whether the election of Emmanuel Macron gave signals about how the European Union would manage both internal and external issues. We're joined by three experts on Europe who each brought a different area of study to understanding Europe. Mark Amsler is the director of the Europe Institute at the University of Auckland and professor of languages. He's the author of Affective Literacies, Writing and Multilingualism in the Later Middle Ages. Simon Green is pro-vice chancellor and executive dean of the School of Languages and Social Sciences at Aston University in the UK. His books include The Politics of Exclusion, Institutions and Immigration Policy in Contemporary Germany, The Politics of the New Germany, and Understanding the Transformation of Germany CDU. John Morgan was also with us. He is professor in the School of Education and Pedagogy at the University of Auckland, and his publications include Schooling the Crisis, Education in the Aftermath of the Global Financial Crisis, and What Do We Mean by Thinking Geographically?
Thank you, everybody, for coming. It's the first time we're getting to coordinate with the Europe Institute, so I'm very excited about that. Very excited to see you all here. So I thought we would start with essentially what all this means. Heading into the French election, after the election of Donald Trump, after Brexit, there was a sense of anxiety about what is going to happen. And depending on what happens, what does it mean? Now, after the election occurred, there were a couple of narratives in the media. One was a big sigh of relief. But then there was another narrative that was emerging, more from the very conservative side, which is, now, good for them, let's watch Europe implode. So I thought the first thing we should do is talk about this French election in the context of, you know, generally, what does this mean? What are the possibilities? Is one narrative totally true, or is it somewhere in the middle? Mark Amsler, why don't you start?
Narratives in the media, and particularly in the political media, are absolutely crucial. And there's no question that there are two relatively different narratives about what's been going on worldwide with respect to changes in national election politics, changes in leadership and government, even changes in the discourse, right, of what's going on. And no clearer is that the case than in Europe. To me, it's a difficult call, because when people are sighing with relief that the EU has, quote unquote, dodged a bullet, they said this after the Netherlands election in March as well, when a far right or extremely clearly nationalist populist party was gaining a lot of traction and then was pushed aside in the final voting, the sigh of relief is for essentially a center-right coalition. That's sort of where we are. So the question of social democracy, the question of the large state enterprises that Europe is best known for, are somehow secondary to that particular narrative. So when people talk about a sigh of relief that, well, we dodged that bullet, the extreme nationalist populist argument, xenophobic, discriminatory, very much a closed or protectionist approach, it's because it's a difficult narrative to sustain, because the alternative is, to some extent, a kind of status quo, let's not rock the boat too much. And if anything, all these elections have shown and continue to show that that's precisely what people want to do, that they want to rock the boat. They want they want something different than what is considered to be the establishment politics. And no clearer example of that than is the election of Macron, who is on the one hand a center-right candidate, but out of the blue from a party that didn't exist a year and a half ago and so forth, not one of the traditional two French parties. So I see this as a narrative in the making and not one of the two established narratives.
Simon Green, what would you say to that?
First of all, it's wonderful to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation to come and join you for this Flash Forum. It's really good to be able to kind of, from one European Study Centre in Britain, of course, to come and talk to another European Study Centre in New Zealand about this. There's an awful lot going on in all of this. Let me just make a kind of put this in a slightly different way to what the way Mark has put this, and perhaps that will generate a bit of discussion about this. I think what we're seeing with In the elections in Europe, and we've seen it in Britain, we've seen it in France, we've seen it in the Netherlands. We are also to a certain extent going to see it in Germany, although it's a slightly different case, also for historical reasons. I wouldn't put it necessarily in the same category. Is, I think, a whole kind of breaking down of the traditional norms of politics. And what I mean by that is that traditionally politics is organised around economic cleavages, and that's what we've seen in the whole kind of development of the party systems. If you go back to Lipset and Rakan, that's exactly what they kind of predict from the 60s, the freezing of the party cleavages around the idea of basically socioeconomic interests. And that, of course, has been gradually breaking down. It's been breaking down since the 1970s, first with post-materialist cleavages, but now it's breaking down whole lots of other ways, including with things like volatility, electoral volatility, fragmentation, all these kind of developments of the party system which have been going on for some time. But it's now kind of reaching a very interesting new level. And I think what's interesting at the moment, and you see this with Marine Le Pen, and I think and particularly also with Brexit, is that the situation in some of these countries is really dividing the electorate. And let me focus perhaps here on the British case, because it's particularly convenient. We have a clear divide in Britain between leavers and remainers. And that divide since the 23rd of June has not shifted. All the polls show that if we ask the question, was it the right decision, was it the wrong decision, it's steady. Basically, it's 40, somewhere between 44 who say it was the right decision, 42 who say it was the wrong decision, and the rest of don't knows. Yeah, so, and that's basically stable right the way through. So we have now increasingly deeply divided and polarised societies, and I think the same thing is going to be in the case in France. The people who voted for Marine Le Pen will be very proud of it. They're not going to come back and say, oh, it was a terrible mistake for us voting for Marine Le Pen. Actually, they know very well why they did it. And I think what that means is that we are moving away from this traditional socioeconomic cleavage to something which is much more strongly identity focused. So the parties, the electorates is focusing much more on questions of identity than they are on questions of economic wealth. And you see this again very clearly in Britain, whereby if you say to people, yeah, but you voted to leave, you do know that's going to make you poorer. They say, yes. Yes, we do know that, and we're okay with that. Not everybody, obviously, but there's a surprising number of people who actually, yeah, we understand that, we get that, but actually it's worth it. And it's not about sovereignty so much. I think it's actually about identity. Now, the thing is, what that means, of course, is that our party systems are very poorly set up to reflect that. And that's where there's then a real space for new parties to come in and completely challenge that status quo and to do something completely different. And the existing parties do not have an answer. And if you want the classic example of that, look at Labour. Labour has no answer to this. They do not know what to do. And banging on, as Jeremy Corbyn is doing, about politics for the many, not for the few, it's clearly not going to get him very far.
John Morgan, do you agree?
Not much more to say, actually. But, I mean, I think there's... I'm sort of add that there are... Those narratives are sort of... The question really is how far those narratives apply across national borders in some ways. I think they are general stories and narratives, but they also have local inflections, as Simon's just begun to say. Brexit is slightly different from the French case, and I think it's quite important just to untangle them. In terms of the French election, I think the very strongly framed in terms of a battle between globalisation and localisation. The openness represented by Macron, the closeness of Le Pen, the sort of the youth, the 39-year-old, tech savvy and so on. So the openness of borders versus the closeness is one element. The new divides, and of course Simon's talked about, you know, André Gortz talked about the farewell to the working class in the 1970s. I mean, this is a long de-alignment of traditional political systems. And new cleavages open up. In France, the argument of the book by the geographer Christophe Guillier, who called The Twilight of the Elites, which said that France is now divided between the metropolitan London, Paris, Lyon axes, the bike sharing, Uber using, latte sipping Frenchman, versus the sort of the peripheral France, the land of the sort of the traditional cheeses, where everybody is tied to the ancestral, which is voting Le Pen. And the Financial Times this morning showed the maps of where the allegiances were strongest. And there is this strong sort of peripheral central divide, which feeds into the globalization narrative very clearly. And then I think the final one really is the sort of the older stories of nationalism, which again are linked to that, around the sort of le pays légal, the notion that to be a Frenchman is something that can be legislated for, or a French person can be legislated for, versus the notion of le pays réel, which is the sense that to be French, you have to be in the land. It feels to me that we're a long way from 1998, when a multicultural French football team with Thierry Henry and Emmanuel Petit sort of told a story about French as an inclusive, open place. And all these are overlaid. So I think the sort of the interesting question is how far those local narratives, if you like, can be translated to more global debates or more European debates as a whole. Will we see the same types of arguments and narratives emerging in Europe in the next 10, 15 years, I guess?
Point about identity versus the issue of the economy and those as sort of separate realms. And I suppose when you say identity, perhaps we should break that down a little bit, because this is what you hear anecdotally, I think, a lot. The concerns that traditional people who have been in Europe for generations feel about immigration. It's a similar theme, I think, that has been happening in the United States and the polarization around that. Is that what you meant when you said identity?
Not exactly, actually. I think our identity is actually much more about community. The areas which, in that sense, where that sense of identity, loss of identity, is particularly strong, are of course those areas which have really suffered with deindustrialization. And I think you would see that that would go for France. It would also go for Germany. And of course, the interesting thing, as we've seen in most European countries, there's an inverse relationship between levels of migration and votes for an extreme right party. So in other words, people vote for an extreme right party, and same with Marine Le Pen, same with Front National. It's all in the northeast. Well, there's not that many migrants there. I mean, in Toulon and the Marseille is a slightly different thing, but they're actually a core support is in those areas around Champagne and Lorraine. And there aren't that many migrants there. Simply, likewise, in the the people who vote for UKIP in the northeast, quite a lot in the northeast and in Lincolnshire, there's actually not that many. Some pockets, but it's actually there is an inverse relationship. So what we're seeing, I think, is more that the idea that immigration is the whipping boy for all kinds of other questions of loss of community and belonging, which various communities have actually felt.
And so where does the economic issue come in?
All right, okay. Where does the economic... Oh, well, I mean, I think really quite strong. We struggled in Europe, I think, generally, to know what to do with the great mass of people who in the new kind of digitalized world, sorry, terrible cliche, but in that new kind of economy, actually aren't terribly productive. And basically what we've done in the past is we've kind of offloaded them onto the welfare system. That's the way we've done it. But actually, perhaps unsurprisingly, it turns out that people aren't actually all that keen on that, because it doesn't really give them much meaning. To basically be shunted off into early retirement at age 50 or 55 with no real kind of prospect for the future, they don't necessarily like it all that much. So we've really struggled to know how to accommodate people who really can't, who've struggled to fit in with that fast-changing economic change in the economic environment. That's a massive challenge, I think, for all European countries, alongside, of course, demographics.
The other side of that, I think, is that Europe, in particular, has had a longstanding and increasingly an accelerating youth unemployment issue, not just in Spain, not just in Portugal, but area-wide, region-wide. And the question of how to not just get more jobs for people under the age of 30 or under the age of 28 and so forth, but also the education and the training that goes with that. You can't just get jobs for people. They have to be educated and trained to do certain kinds of things, or to do things that they think are productive and so forth, and that are productive and that can sustain them. And in that respect, the when you look at the election results, and this was true in the Netherlands as well, a substantial number of people under the age of 30 were voting for the alternative right candidates, whatever they might be. And I think that was true in the second round in France as much as in the first round among the different parties and so forth. The idea that the youth will lead us into a more liberal, socially democratic future, I think is a long gone belief. I don't think it's mistaken. I think it's a good idea, but there has to be some reason for people to come to that. And that's where education comes in. And this is why I think the implications of Brexit are, down the line, are even more complicated than perhaps we might even imagine, because a good number of people on the continent who have sought higher education and advanced training and so forth, and then the jobs to go with that, have gone to the UK, right, as part of the European Union contract. If that doesn't exist anymore, then you've got another stumbling block, right, in the midst of that movement of people as well as goods and services and capital. So I think that there really needs to be a stronger emphasis on increased or widened education, deepened education, retention, etc. And the resources for that. That seems to me to be a EU effort, or should be, not just an individual nationalistic effort, although individual nation states have their own educational programs. Nonetheless, it's the cooperation among the partner nations, member nations, that has made that worthwhile.
Yeah, I think this relationship between identity and the issues of globalization and deindustrialization, which Simon alluded to, are very important and quite complex. There was a letter in the New Zealand Herald which said that the French were faced with the choice between neoliberalism and neo-fascism. And unsurprisingly, they went for neoliberalism. It's a very interesting statement. But what it taps into, I think, is this sense amongst the liberal, centre and liberal classes that these votes, the UKIP vote and the votes for the Front National in France, are racist votes, in a sense. Racist parties, racist voters. David Runciman, a week after the Brexit vote, in the London Review of Books, wrote, 18.5 million people voting for Leave is not necessarily a racist vote. People weren't doing this out of ignorance. They were doing this out of something real. The question becomes, what is this real that they are relating to? Runciman's answer is it's the sense of those people who feel that the globalization agenda has left them behind. In a sense, Runciman argues, this is the first time that those on the liberal left and centre-left have lost an election in 40 years in the UK. And they are now finding out what happens when you lose elections. But he's saying the wealthy, the connected, the young, the tech-savvy will be able to develop their networks to escape the effects of Brexit, whereas those left behind who voted for it will be living in their localities, in their communities, and so on. So the question, I think, politically is there any role for a party which can buck the trend and suggest there's an alternative to the models of globalization that are being suggested by May and by Macron in France? They really are. I mean, if the New Zealand Herald writer is right in saying this is neoliberalism, can we have globalization but with a rather different set of inflections and models? Not sure that Macron offers that at present, but he may be forced to take a different stance in relation to what happens with the electoral colleges next.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and this week's program on the future of Europe was recorded before a live audience with Professors Mark Amsler, John Morgan, and Simon Green.
We've all been sort of alluding to the cooperation within the EU and what this might mean in terms of the economy, but also all of the crises that we faced with the sovereign debt crisis, with the structural issues that really led to that. I wonder if we can also speak to what this might mean looking at these structural problems. Simon?
So how long have we got? I think that the clearly Europe has really struggled with the through the absence of a proper Franco-German motor. I think that's been a real problem which has been going on now, ever since Sarkozy became prime minister. President. It's going to be very interesting to see how this develops, because on the one hand, you know, first of all, Macron actually has to say, I want to take on this role of leadership. But then, of course, Angela Merkel also has to say, yeah, all right, I'll share it with you, because she is so strongly now established herself as the leader of in that sense, of the driver of so many things in Europe. Now, of course, Germany has this leadership avoidance reflex for historical reasons. It doesn't like to be in a position where it is dictating things to other people. It likes to share that responsibility, which is why France, of course, was very useful in that regard. And that's why the Franco-German relationship sort of started off. However, if there's one thing that politicians really, really don't want to give up, it's power. So in that sense, I'll be very interested to see how Chancellor Merkel actually approaches this one. But my suspicion is she'll actually embrace this as an opportunity, because she was thrust into a role which she didn't really seek for herself or for Germany. So I think Germany would actually welcome a greater involvement by France. But I think picking up on John's point here about the vision, and that's this is an enormous issue. You know, the thing is that we don't have a situation whereby, you know, to articulate in an electorally palatable way a vision of globalization which does not subscribe to the existing paradigms around it's a good thing and you just got to suck it up and love it. Yeah, this is a fantastic challenge. This is a kind of, you have to have people not just once in a generation, it has to be once in a kind of in a century. So I don't see that person yet in anywhere. And of course, ultimately, because we have the way that modern politics is, most politicians are, and Angela Merkel is the embodiment of this, are incredibly cautious. They are fantastically cautious. They don't put their heads above the parapet on anything, because at the end of the day, and again, it's understandable, the key concern of all politicians is to be re-elected.
I wanted to get your sense about Macron himself. What do we know about him that might give us a hint about where he might go on these issues?
I'm going to be very short on this, but Macron seems to me, my original feeling, he reminded me of 20 years ago Tony Blair being elected in the UK. He's a technocrat. He's part of the central liberal techno elite in those senses. He's been involved in the European project and the sort of the business agenda. He is not offering anything that doesn't sort of challenge that narrative. So, for instance, one of the things he said fairly recently in February was to the environmental movement. And he said, actually, I think the environmental problem have got an issue here. I am not against growth in any sense. And for me, that is one of the missing narratives of this French election. It's very interesting to us overseas who have sort of picked up Thomas Piketty's, you know, sort of best-selling economics book. My impression of France is it's a left-leaning liberal in democracy where people are beginning to challenge the narrative of growth and pro-growth. We have the sort of the décroissance movement, the degrowth movement, which again is sort of well written about in places like New Zealand, where people are saying we need to sort of go against carbon, we need to find a way to degrow our economies. We have Macron who's actually saying we need more European integration upon the European model. We need to develop the techno hubs of northern France and its relationship with London and with Berlin. We need to follow the human capital route, which is to educate people to higher levels so that they can get the high-tech jobs. What he is not in any sense to me is challenging any of the narratives. So he's talked about the Paris Agreement in relation to Trump and said that he will try and honour France's sort of commitment to this. But in a sense, it's business as usual, a little bit better. And it comes from sort of, I suppose in many ways, without personalising it, it comes from the sort of the social milieu that he's part of the French European elite. And I don't want to get carried away, but it's very interesting that when I started reading The Guardian, who were sort of virtually every comment made by French voters that they translated into The Guardian were saying, we didn't want to vote for him, we felt we had to. And that is a really interesting, I mean, it's very interesting narrative that, that when it comes down to it, there is, as Simon's suggesting, no alternative. So that people who don't necessarily want this politics end up in the end saying, well, it's better than what might come otherwise. And at what point do those on the left begin to articulate another, and I'm talking the centre left here, begin to articulate another story rather than just saying, well, we had to vote for him, we didn't want to, but it's better than what was coming anyway. So it's a sense it sort of comes down to sort of where are the social movements going to emerge that can challenge the sort of the technical business as usual narrative.
So essentially what I'm hearing coming from both of you really is that we'll probably see more of the same and not a big tackling of the big structural problems.
The news coverage I watched last evening was the big question being raised by the French journalists who were interviewing their sort of talking heads was, would he have the nerve to take on the organised labour in? And the argument is that he wants to basically, business leaders supporting him have been saying we need to have a more flexible labour force and a lower wage labour force. Doesn't seem that in any sense the politics is new. That seems that we've had 20 years of that narrative.
Mark Amsler.
A couple of things. One is that both in the campaign and in the his post-election comments and so forth, he reiterated his desire to rewrite various parts of labor regulations and labor law in France. That was one thing. I thought that stood out. And as many of us know here, you know, when people say they want to review the program, you know that change is coming in a particular way. The secondly. He was the economic minister in Hollande's government. I mean, that was the point. That was his job. He was very much involved with negotiations in the Greek sovereign debt crisis. That's his job. He's an investment banker. That's his job. I mean, that's the person who's been elected as president of France, who now is also talking about social unity, about bringing together and closing down divisiveness in the name of a kind of French culture of cosmopolitanism, and so forth, all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, his fundamental orientation is economic. And in a sense, there's a way in which there's a part of me that thinks, well, okay, if the rejection of a certain kind of globalization, in all of its manifestations, has come about because it hasn't necessarily delivered on the goods, the claim for individualized capitalism hasn't necessarily benefited everybody in the way that sometimes is promised. Is there a way in which that could be done differently and so forth? And there are economists in the room who can speak to this more specifically and will, I hope, in the second half hour here. But there's only so many ways you can do that in the current capitalist state systems. Keynesian economics comes to mind immediately, of course. And to some extent, the French system, its infrastructure, is banging along relatively well by comparison with other larger and smaller nations, both worldwide and in Europe specifically. So why is there so much discontent? I mean, you know, Simon's talked about it in terms of economic identity issues and so forth. You know, northeastern France, Marseille, and so forth. Marseille, of course, a long-standing National Front region, and so forth and so on. And immigration is your trigger. But I think I couldn't agree more that that's just a trigger. You know, the homophobia and more particularly the xenophobia and whatnot, the anti-Muslim rhetoric and all that sort of thing is the trigger for something much deeper. And I think that's where his real challenge will come, to change a certain kind of status quo mentality. And I say not just France, but the EU. And a lot of the comments from the European Union's upper echelons and so forth have been, well, you know, this just shows that, you know, we can do things right and we're going to get along. And it's a lot of it is the status quo talk, that we need some reforms. We don't need to tinker too much outside of the edge, beyond the edges and so forth and so on. When in fact, I took the vote and a number of sentiments in Europe to be precisely the opposite of that. And the Brexit referendum was perhaps the most, glaring, response to that question. But it, I think there's a certain complacency, that's my sense, among the EU ruling class, and a sense of the status quo. And I don't think that that's going to be very helpful. It certainly isn't going to help Macron in bringing France around.
I suppose the status quo argument is a really interesting one. It's quite a difficult one. I mean, if we look at the structures and the fundamentals, you mentioned that France is actually ticking along not too badly. They have a very very good public infrastructure. They have productivity levels that we in the UK would just die for. I mean, it's fantastic. So actually, in that sense, maybe France is the case actually where just a bit of tinkering around the edges might actually be enough to deal with the things which people really are concerned about, namely in particular, of course, things like youth unemployment, which is quite, you quite rightly identified, and which is very high in France. So So it may be possible, rather than having a wholesale massive reform, which has sometimes been talked about as being necessary in France, that actually Macron could get away with something much more kind of modest. However, of course, the fact that he's not come from one of the two traditional parties, and he is probably not going to get a majority in the legislative elections which are coming up, that's going to make things very difficult. So in that sense, you're going to get probably a reinforcement of this vote now, which will ultimately continue that divide in the country, and then bridging it is going to be very, very difficult.
You have been listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and this week's program discussing the future of Europe was recorded before a live audience. With us were Professors Mark Hamsler and John Morgan from the University of Auckland, and Professor and Dean Simon Green from Aston University in the UK. When we come back, we'll continue exploring what's next for Europe. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and this week's program on the future of Europe was recorded before a live audience with Professors Mark Hamsler, John Morgan, and Simon Green.
There are two layers. One is France itself, and the possibility that tinkering around the edges is enough. But then there's the bigger picture, and I think that's where the big issues are. Would you agree?
The bigger picture in terms of the European Union. So I have to say, I think the European Union is often imbued with an awful lot of significance and status and in that sense power when it's basically forgotten that the EU is nothing more than the collection of its member states. The member states make the laws, the member states implement the laws. Anything the European Union does is only there because the member states agree to it, including Britain. So in that sense, if we're looking to if we want to stop, or if Europe wants to stop the EU from being seen as being bad, almost along with immigration, as the source of all evil and everything which is bad in Europe, then actually member states need to stop actually blaming the EU for everything that goes wrong and taking the credit for everything that goes right. And this is absolutely, I mean, it's really interesting when you look after European Council summit and you watch the different, if you watch the French TV and you watch the German TV and you watch the British TV, well, not there anymore obviously, but if we were there it would be exactly the same thing, because after each European Council summit every single national leader goes into their national briefing rooms, their national media, and they say, we won won and we saved our country from those nasty other Europeans. Well, if you're going to do that, then, you know, it's going to leave, it's going to lead to the position that people will think the European Union is a bit of a waste of time. So it is actually, in that sense, ultimately, it is in everybody's hands. It's not some kind of magic organisation which has the ability to do things which others don't. So I think there's a kind of a disconnect of logic there.
Would you agree?
I think that it's very interesting. I think that there is a sense in which we have to look at different phases of the project of Europeanisation and European integration. I mean, the original six, which was then made to the original nine in the mid-1970s, and that effectively was the end of European integration and expansion. There were no plans to take it further. What, of course, prompted this further round of immigration was the coming down of the Berlin Wall, the attempt to to offset anti-democratic trends in Spain and Portugal, and to incorporate more into the system, and really the fiscal crises that national governments faced in a way. Whereas in the post-war period, they were prepared to pay social welfare bills. Unemployment and inflation by the mid-1970s had created a crisis of the fiscal crisis of the state in many places, and European integration seemed to offer a way out. The market seemed to offer a way forward. So governments took gladly the process of being involved in larger markets. And I think that's the sort of process of European integration that we've seen. And that has taken place, I think, without much real debate. So if you look at national elections, and my own experience of living in Britain, Europe was always a side issue in the 1970s, even through the 1980s. The same true in France. There's never been a Europe question in terms of the French election until 2012. So what was it that brings Europe to the fore and makes virtually every referendum and every election now that takes place in the European space a referendum on Europe? It is to do with the actual collapse of that economic model after 2008, which brings into contradiction the gap between the markets and monetary integration and fiscal prudence, where everybody tries to reduce their public debt, versus the needs of states to provide for their people. And that, I think, is the other way of looking at the globalization issue here, is to say, in how will the welfare services be provided in European states for its citizenry, and how will the needs of the market be met by the states? And I think that's the sort of Wolfgang Straeck talks about the notion that we are in a democratic crisis now. For many, many years, we've assumed that democracy is the best fit for capitalism. We might be at a point where democracy and capitalism part their ways.
To be fair, Straeck does like to overrate.
Yeah.
Mark Amsler.
I think that John's touched on a couple of really interesting and important points. The fact that the European Union is a topic of debate is an interesting one. I've done some work recently in terms of political narratives, national narratives, and so forth. And you can take a corpus just do European Union, for example, as a phrase, and look at the number of times the term European Union or EU appears in a particular discourse, and looking at it in different contexts, whether it be the public media, academic journals, public documents related to various kinds of state institutions, welfare system, etc. And increasingly, the point is, as you say, increasingly the European Union has become a topic, right, within this debate. And it's, in a sense, it's a kind of free-floating signifier. It moves around in a discourse in such a way that you can blame it, and you can praise it, you can slough stuff off to it, and so forth and so on. And in a sense, it has that kind of amorphous possibility for serving different purposes as a discursive item, as a place within a discourse for praise and blame. The other side of it is that the EU, to some extent, is as a concept, as an entity, and it is a reality in Europe. Let's not forget that it's not just a concept, but it is a real thing. But it exists, as you say, only with the 28 member states specifically, and what they agree to. Things have to be done unanimously. There's no proportionate voting here. If it's not unanimous, it doesn't happen. happen in so many instances. So that said, the regulations that are that and the values and the kind of conditions regarding everything from social democracy and anti-discrimination laws to fiscal policies to monetary policies and so forth that are in, put in, into the EU framework and so forth, then are enshrined or instantiated within national laws and so forth and laws. And so that's a crucial bit in all of this. That said, the way that the EU then appears in the discourse sometimes functions as what Roland Barthes called inoculation, right? The idea that you talk about how it's the institution's not quite right, it's got some problems and so forth, but we're going to praise it, right? We're going to keep it. You inoculate the criticism, and then you save the status quo and so forth. And I think that that's pretty much what's going on right now. So the challenge that John Morgan just raised is, well, what is the alternative, right? Is, I think, the challenge of the decade, if not the millennium, but the challenge of the decade as far as Europe goes. And that applies then to Europe and its global partners. And so we can talk about the United States, we can talk about eventually China, we can talk about the Australasia region, et cetera, et cetera.
We've got a couple of elections coming up. Do we have any idea about how these are going to go? Germany, Britain, Simon Green?
Right. So, thank you. So, let's start with the easy one, Germany.
Why is that easy?
Because what's interesting, of course, is that on the day of the second round of the French election, also, and I'm sure you were all watching this very carefully, was the regional election in Schleswig-Holstein, and we have the upcoming election in Nordrhein-Westfalen as well. And regional elections, it's fantastic. German politics is fantastic because after the election is always before the election. There is never an election-free period in Germany because of all these weird and wonderful regional elections, and we've still got Bavaria to come as well, which is also always a particular joy. But Schleswig-Holstein, why does it matter? Because it's a pretty small state up on the between Hamburg and the Danish border, and it has a fairly small population. Well, it matters because the SPD lost. And they were expected to win because they were in the government and they'd actually lost. Now that it matters because basically in the context of the SPD's chancellor candidate, Martin Schulz, who came from the European Parliament to great fanfare and great welcome in the SPD, everybody thought he was going to change the dynamics for the Social Democrats, which was going to challenge Angela Merkel. That seems to be petering out, fizzing out quite rapidly. But what's also important is that the populist, extreme right, however you want to call this, it kind of veers between the two, the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD, managed to get into the regional parliament, but didn't really do all that well. It didn't do quite as well as it had hoped and it had expected. So there's a couple of interesting trends which are kind of emerging from this for the national picture, which the North Rhine-Westphalian election may yet confirm. But what it does mean is that the CDU is looking on target to remain the largest party. It seemed, I would guess, it's unlikely that they will achieve 41% again, as they did in 2013. That's a historically high level of vote, and was predicated on the fact that people left, the voters of the Liberal FDP left for the CDU. But the FDP also appears to be enjoying something of a renaissance, so it may yet return into the national parliament. So we'll see. So I think there is actually a kind of sense of more like business as usual, but partially, of course, because the AfD, like so many populist parties, once it gets a whiff of power, actually implodes because the people who run these parties are completely incapable of actually maintaining some kind of coherent position to the extent that we have the new leader of UKIP saying, oh, we're not really necessary anymore. Well, that's maybe not what you should say as a party leader. Which brings me neatly to Britain, where yes, indeed, it does seem to be a fairly clear outcome that Theresa May will be returned with a very large majority, and a lot of Labour seats are going to become unsafe. principally because what we're seeing is actually the coalescing back of the of UKIP into the Conservative votes. That's what's really happening in Britain. So the fragmentation of the right is now ending, at least temporarily. I don't think it will end permanently, but I think for this election we've seen UKIP voters who say, okay, we no need to vote for UKIP anymore, we'll vote for the Conservatives, and that's what's putting the Conservatives in the driving seat. Now, what this will mean is that you've got, what we see already is two completely diametrically opposed views on this. There are the Brexiteers, the hardline Brexiteers, who say, great, we need a big majority so that we can really sock it to Brussels. But then you get those people who are the soft exiteers, who actually would quite like to stay in the single market, who say, great, we need a big majority so that Theresa May can finally tell the hardline ideologues where to get off. Well, those two positions don't match up. They are diametrically opposed and mutually exclusive. So how that's going to play out, well, we will see. But that is why I think that the fragmentation of the right in Britain is not yet over. And actually the Conservative Party, which is, we're looking at the moment at Labour, that's the obvious one to look at. But I've always thought that actually the split of the Conservative Party is a real possibility on this, as over Europe, effectively, because once one group becomes disappointed with the outcome of Brexit, as somebody surely will have to be, there is a real risk of a split. The Conservatives are very good at keeping power, but I think that's a real risk for them.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and this week's program on the future of Europe was recorded before a live audience with Professors Mark Amsler, John Morgan, and Simon Green.
Do you agree, John Morgan?
I'm sort of quite glad not to be in the UK for this election, and I don't know how to answer this question. I'm not following it as closely as I would if I was in the UK. I have some questions, really, though. We'll raise them. One, does this... If that outcome is, as Simon has described it, is this really the what's on now called the breakup of Britain? Is this really, will we see a second Scottish sort of referendum to dissociate itself? Will we see that force growing in Wales? Will we see some sort of notions of regional devolution in the northeast, for instance? I'm wondering whether or not there is a sort of, with the Conservative Party still being the party of England, I mean, is this the final death knell in Britain and the UK, I suppose, is my question. The second is really a point that Mark raised around social movements and the youth, in a way. We're talking here as though politics sort of matters to us all. But frankly, the rates of sort of abstention, rates of protest voting, I mean, will we see the notion of an extra parliamentary politics emerging where people begin to say, well, neither of these parties or any of these parties are beginning to speak for the types of society that we want to see emerging in the next 20, 30, 40 years in a sort of an era of secular stagnation where the IMF says that economic growth will not sort of return to those levels for another 50 years, where people have to rely on the bank of mum and dad in order to get on the housing market. There might be a way in which I'm interested is how people will respond to this. Someone will know more on this. The Lib Democrats were talking about the possibility of saying they will have a second referendum on, and will that lead to some sort of mass vote? Well, in a sense, will this become another referendum on Brexit? I don't know. Those are all my questions from outside. You're saying no to that.
I lied when I said there were only two more questions, because there was another one that's sort of burning and I thought, well, don't ask it. But I just keep thinking people have framed these elections, not just one, but all of them, as a rebuke of Trump, right? And I don't really see this French election as a rebuke of Trump, necessarily. I see that there was a rejection of Marine Le Pen by 2/3. There's still a third that certainly did vote for her. Does Donald Trump enter into this at all, Mark Amsler?
Donald Trump.
Were people watching the U.S. saying, "We don't want that"?
No, I don't. I don't really think that. You know, I think that that's an analytic narrative that gets constructed. I don't think it's irrelevant, but I think that it emerges at a level by which you're doing comparative politics. You're doing events, narrative, action, analysis, and so forth and so on. I do think one of the things that's interesting, though, and I think this is what actually gives me some hope. is that all of this stuff over the last, say, 18 months or so has really ignited people's interest. People are paying attention. I'm not interested at this level in which side of the fence you're on, but people are paying attention in ways that I haven't seen in decades. They're looking at the news. They're comparing different kinds of newscasts. They're making choices about, well, I'm going to listen to that more than this, and so forth and so on. And there's always been some of that, of course, you know, your favorite media outlets and so forth, and everybody's got their own bubble and so forth and so on. But there's a lot of interest, and even the very notion of the bubbles and the comparison of bubbles and so forth has become itself part of a new level, to me, a new level of awareness, a new level of consciousness. People in the United States and people on Facebook and in different kinds of networks are talking about the French election, who have no relationship to France other than it's part of global politics. So I think that's actually promising, and that's something that we can certainly, you know, build on in our classes, we can build on in our academic work, we can build on in our public work and so forth. We can think about it in the context of how do you take that further as a way to enrich that, right? To make it work. And from that comes the possibility of political action. All right. And so I see that as a real stepping stone toward increased political action. But you got to make people believe, or get them to believe, that it's worth doing.
You know, that's actually a perfect lead into what was and is now my last question. People are engaged in the question of what happens in these European elections. Does it influence us in our life, in our civics, in our politics here, Mark Amsler? And if so, how?
Well, the only thing I'll say about, well, one thing I can say about that is when I spoke with Radio Live after the results were in, and they asked me to, you know, off the cuff. I mean, this kind of commentary is a bit strange when you're just speaking off the cuff, you know. And it's good to have a few bits of numbers with you to back it all up. But they said, well, what do you think of what's going on? And I said, well, actually, you know, the new French president will sound very familiar to a lot of New Zealanders. He believes in strong, responsible, economic, fiscal policies. He wants to stimulate growth. He wants to expand productivity. He's liberal, quote unquote, you know, on many social issues. He's an investment banker. I mean, hello, right? This is partly the national government for the last 7 years. That there's a kind of comfort zone, you know, in all of that. It's a familiar scene, and that's part of the question about the status quo, then, right? But the other side of it is that it also is the connection part. It's not about, you know, Europe, whatever part of Europe, right? One's ancestors might have come from as migrants. That Europe is somehow that other part of my ancestral history and so forth. But it's also part of a global economy. The debates about TPP. Likewise stimulated, I think, similar kinds of sense of connectedness and whatnot. So this is the good kind of connectedness that gets you thinking about what actually is going on, and not the sense that there's a kind of overriding dominance that's taking over. And that's, again, I think that's a positive thing. I've never particularly felt that New Zealand was far away, you know, but that's a particular generational issue. And this just accelerates, I think, that feeling of its connectedness more and more.
Very quickly, I mean, I think that what was said right at the beginning of this discussion is that the old politics is in the process of breaking up, and I think that the interesting thing is to make the links between Brexit, France, what's happening in Italy, Germany, Trump as well, and these things happen at different rates and in different places. But I think there is a sense in which what will be born as a result of the breakup of the traditional cleavages within political systems, and they won't be national issues only. They will be, everything is reflexive, as Mark has said. Now these votes are now, they reverberate around the world, and they influence and feed back on people's larger conceptions. So, I mean, I think, you know, in a sense that the European Union has taken 60 years to evolve to this point. It won't collapse overnight. We will see a period of shifts and changes. And the same is true of political systems. The interesting question is whether an alternative will emerge to the dominant narratives that have shaped the world for the last 30 years. At the moment, there seems to be very little alternative. And as it's been suggested, where alternatives emerge, they disappear and they fragment.
What does our visitor think?
As I don't live in New Zealand, I think it would be entirely presumptuous of me to comment on how it
but
might affect...
But you're here now.
But I'm here now.
Well, do you like New Zealand?
Yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's quite nice, really. Yeah, it's perfectly pleasant. Yes. I mean, you know, New Zealand is an OECD country, so it's of course part of that kind of broader global network. But I mean, I think it, you know, in that sense, it is a shame, of course, that we in Europe know very little of what goes on in Australasia. I mean, we have no real sense of it. It never really appears in the news at all. A bit like Northern Ireland and Britain, to be perfectly honest, which also never appears in the news. I think that's a shame. I think actually part of that kind of sense of we in Britain spend so much time looking in America. My students know more about the American elections than they do about the French elections. And you think, oh, hang on a minute, you know, that's their next door to us and they're a long way away. But that's the kind of the fascination that we have. And but perhaps, you know, I agree with you though that actually we see a greater sense of engagement, which was probably always there. I don't think it was actually ever the political interest ever went away. It just people didn't really like that kind of doing it through parties. They wanted to do it through slightly different ways. But yeah, the issues now just kind of really mobilised, and perhaps then that does encourage us to see more the connect, how things connect between different types of countries.
Well, why don't we thank our panelists? Thank you very much.
This week's program discussing the future of Europe was recorded before a live audience. With us were Professors Mark Amsler and John Morgan, and Professor and Dean Simon Green. Mark Amsler is the director of the Europe Institute at the University of Auckland and professor of languages. He's the author of Affective Literacies, Writing and Multilingualism in the Later Middle Ages. Simon Green is pro-vice chancellor and executive dean of the School of Languages and Social Sciences at Aston University in the UK. His books include The Politics of Exclusion, Institutions and Immigration Policy in Contemporary Germany, The Politics of the New Germany, and Understanding the Transformation of Germany CDU. John Morgan was also with us. He is professor in the School of Education and Pedagogy at the University of Auckland, and his publications include Schooling the Crisis, Education in the Aftermath of the Global Financial Crisis, and What Do We Mean by Thinking Geographically?
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.